Hey there, beautiful people. Welcome to Fanti, the podcast for all those complex and complicated conversations about the gray areas in our lives. I am tired. Oh. Also known as Travell Anderson.
I am journalist, writer, and producer Jared Hill. Coming up on the show today, we're going to be getting into the first of a two-part series on colorism. We've been teasing this one for a little bit of time, and Travell is really excited to probably ask me questions to hurt my feelings. We'll get into that a little bit later, but first, before we get into this popcorn passing, I want to let you know that this is a trigger warning. We're going to be discussing Bill Cosby for the next few minutes. However, not really discussing specific alleged sexual assaults, but the case in general. So I want to let you know that. It is time for Pass the Popcorn. Really talking about Bill Cosby, but more so about Felicia Rashad. Here is a little bit of what happened on last week's show. Jarrett, on this episode of Fanti, could not have known that the following morning, after talking about Bill Cosby, there'd be a breaking headline that, quote, Bill Cosby has, quote, been released, end quote, from prison, according to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. Apparently, Bill Cosby got out of jail because they believed he didn't have a fair trial. I can't even process that this just happened because, of course, it happened. So the internet completely shat itself last week when on Wednesday morning, we all woke up to find out that America's dad slash serial rapist who disguised himself as a gynecologist who should never be allowed to have a bartending license, also wow. known as Bill Cosby, wow. was wow. rather unexpectedly released from prison. I was really excited about that one.
I noticed.
Y'all know most of the details by now, but the TLDR version is that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court found that Cosby's whole trial was unconstitutional because it was based on information that was only procured in a way that the court found was essentially not legal. The pivotal evidence in the case, which was a deposition Cosby gave after allegedly being told that he wouldn't be prosecuted in the Andrea Constand case, that is how they got that information. And when a new prosecutor came in on the case, he nixed the alleged deal and used the information from the deposition to then charge Cosby in the final days before the statute of limitations expire. The court said that wasn't fair and subsequently throughout the entire case, releasing Cosby from prison after serving 3 years. I don't know that that was TLDR, but y'all will be fine.
It was not.
Sister Felicia Rashad sparked off her own controversy when she tweeted in celebration of Cosby's release, praising the writing of an injustice, as she called it, in Cosby's case.
What are you saying?
Rashad, the new dean of the Howard University College of Fine Arts, had to issue a not apology, but a little statement or so on Twitter to students that may have feared Rashad could not be sensitive to the needs of students who experience sexual assault. She tweeted, I fully support survivors of sexual assault coming forward. My post was in no way intended to be insensitive to their truth. Personally, I know from friends and family that such abuse has lifelong residual effects. My heartfelt wish is for healing. Now, I got to tell you, I was a little bit jarred Wednesday morning. One, because I had just gotten done talking about Bill Cosby for last week's episode. But I was also really kind of taken aback by the very fuck this dummy bird bitch kind of conversation that I was hearing on social media about Felicia Rashad and her support of Bill Cosby, which I do not support, but I was just jarred by the way we were talking to and about her. How did you think about all of it as it was happening?
I didn't think.
Great. Okay.
You know, it's a clear line for me. I feel like there is no way you can come out with some sort of statement of support for Bill Cosby, because what you're really supporting is what you're really commenting on is not the fact that he assaulted all of these women, and not necessarily on the fact that he, you know, is getting out. Like what you're saying is, yeah, we all knew all this dirty stuff was going down, but you motherfuckers should not have sued him. Like, we know he said he did it, but that ain't the point. It gives just very look over there energy. Is what it's giving to me.
Interesting. I didn't feel that. I mean, I definitely think this is a complex and complicado. I think that I almost said Fantasia because I'm in proximity to you.
You're disrespectful.
I guess this is hard for me because, number one, I hate the impact of this decision from a legal perspective, what they did was right. Right. Like, from a perspective of like, you cannot do this legally, I get that. But I think the impact of it is so trash that it really overshadows whether or not what they did was right or wrong. I know that I don't feel like I can just completely throw away Felicia Rashad over this, but I don't know what to feel about her right now.
My feelings are the same that they've always been, and that they typically are for folks of her generation who just, you know, have a fidelity to being on the wrong side of things. And that is, the listeners can't see, but I looked at my watch on my wrist.
Thank you for that. No, I don't know.
That's all I got.
The other thing I'll say here is that it kind of borders on Trump support. And it's not exactly the same, because I think Donald Trump is a whole other different beast. But like, it is kind of an interesting, uneasy feeling. If you're a Trump supporter, like, you generally get canceled right away by a lot of people, right? But like, I don't know that this equates the same. There's a familiarity that's different. There's a Black womanness that's different. Like, I don't know.
Listen, we love Black women all around here in these streets, but Black women can be wrong too. Okay.
I'm not saying that she's not wrong.
But here's the thing. It's the same conversation we always have as it relates to these, you know, people who we have particular relationships to them or their work or, you know, whatever. And it's the same conversations. And it's either, will I be boycotting projects that Felicia Rashad is in? Probably not. Will I be, you know, waiting for her Kennedy Center Honors recognition? No.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know how to feel about it. Okay, before we go to break, I know that there are plenty of people who have like firm opinions on this, but is it complex and complicado for anybody else but me? Because if it's not, I can accept that I might be wrong on this. I didn't say I was going to change my opinion, but I might just be the contrary bitch on this one. But like, let me know what y'all think. You can hit us up on Twitter, hashtag FantiFam, or Instagram. Both of them have the same handle, at FantiPodcast. When we come back, we've got part one of a very long-awaited conversation on colorism. That's up next.
Fanti is also brought to you by the folks over at Brooklinen. All right, y'all. So I've been doing, I was going to say a lot of traveling, but it hasn't been a lot of traveling, but had some things that I needed to take care of on the East Coast, okay? And so I was staying in you know, the hotels, the little Airbnbs and the Bees, all these other places, all right? But you know what? I needed to get back to my sheets, okay?
I know
your
that's
sheets
right.
Just feel different, right, when they on your bed. When I tell you these Brooklinen sheets that I got, and I got the duvet cover, all right, honey, baby, it just make you feel like you're sleeping on heaven, okay? That's what it make it feel like. You just coasted on a cloud.
Not in heaven, but on heaven.
On heaven, okay? On heaven, because you just know it's soft, all right? So, it's summer again, and that means hot, sunny days and nights that are too hot to get any sleep. Get you some Brooklinen, honey. Crisp sheets that breathe to keep you cool means you can say goodbye to sweaty summer nights. And honey, it has been hot.
Brooklinen works directly with manufacturers to make luxury available directly to you without luxury level markups, so you get their amazing array of products at a reasonable price. I'm talking buttery soft and breathable sheets, plush and absorbent towels, cozy robes, and comfy loungewear you'll want to put on and never take off. They're so confident in their core products that they come with a 365-day warranty. Yes, one full year. And fans are confident, too. They've received over 75,000 plus five-star reviews and counting. So give yourself the comfort, refresh you deserve, and get it for less at Brooklinen. Go to brooklinen.com. Use promo code FANTI to get $20 off. That's BROOKLINEN.com. And enter promo code FANTI for $20 off with a minimum purchase of $100. That's brooklinen.com, promo code FANTI. Whether it's for work or play, a lot of us are going to be on the move again this summer, and you should be taking your Raycons with you. Whether you're listening to FANTI or your favorite song, the new Meg Thee Stallion, or you're out here on your hot vac summer, a pair of Raycon wireless earbuds in your ears can make all the difference. You get crisp, powerful beats at half the price of other premium audio brands. And Raycons are built to go wherever you go with quick and seamless Bluetooth pairing and a compact charging case.
Oh yes, I've been telling y'all for as long as Raycon has been supporting this show about how I love its 24-hour battery life and portability, okay? You can put it in your pocket because it's real compact. You can throw it in your little purse, you know, hun, if you want to go be cute or whatever. Or maybe you're just walking down the street. You need a little bit of air, you know, some fresh air. So you go take a walk around the block, okay? You just go ahead and pop them in and it will help you tune out the rest of the world, right? That way you can just hear our fabulousness in your ear and not all that other stuff going on around you, okay? You're not gonna hear the car honking. You're not gonna hear the construction people next door. You're not gonna hear your neighbors still working out in their apartment.
Raycon's offering 15% off all their products for our listeners. And here's what you gotta do to get it. Go to buyraycon.com/fanti. There you'll get 15% off your entire Raycon order, and it's such a good deal you want to grab a pair and a spare. That's 15% off at buyraycon.com/fanti. buyraycon.com/fanti.
Alrighty, beautiful people. Colorism has been in the news lately from In the Heights and its cast and creators basically saying that the cast of Light Brights were the most talented for the roles.
Wow.
We got Kenya Barris out here expounding on various criticisms of his ish-based empire. And yet another dark-skinned person has been passed up for a role for a lighter-skinned person. I don't know if that last one actually happened recently or not, but it likely has. So, next week, we're going to go deep on colorism specific. What I did?
I just, the light skin slander is just real aggressive, and I just wanted to be clear about that.
You'll be fine.
But go on.
So next week, we're going to go deeper on colorism, specifically in media, though I'm sure we'll touch on that today, too. But we wanted for this first episode, which won't take on the typical fan and anti structure, because obvious. We wanted to focus on how colorism has shown up in our lives on kind of an interpersonal. Does that mean? Yeah, that means you and me, right? Interpersonal way. Thank you. So colorism, for those who need a definition, this is Mrs. Merriam-Webster for you, says prejudice or discrimination, especially within a racial or ethnic group, favoring people with lighter skin over those with darker skin. Jared and I have wanted to have an episode on this for some time, and we thought the best person to help us delve into this, you'll remember them from episode 26. Okay, allies, now let's get information. Executive director of the Stonewall Community Foundation, aka the other Jared, Jared Lucas. Welcome back to Fanti.
Aka fan favorite. Thank you for having me.
Yes.
Jared Lucas, aka the other light meat. Thank you so much for being here on Fanti. I'm excited to have you here. Travel, you have a question that we and I are going to get into first, and then we'll come to Jared Lucas.
So I think, you know, we've pre-produced loosely this episode before when we were talking about how color, you know, potential topics. And you and I shared some things that I think are like the foundation of our conversation that we're having today. So before we bring you in, Jared Lucas, my question is for you, Jared, and myself, is like, what is your earliest memory of like being made aware of your skin tone, and or your earliest memory of being like made to feel a way about your skin tone, if those stories are different? And I'm going to start first. And me, yes, I am taking darker skinned privilege here.
Wow. Right out the gate, we're doing this? Really?
And I stand in solidarity, so. Go ahead, Travella. Take it away.
She's Louise.
This is where you actively listen, Jared.
I shan't. I do not stand for this critical race theory bullshit that y'all are trying to pull up. Go ahead, Travella.
Somebody is going to clip that section of the podcast.
Oh, no.
And that's going to come back to haunt you.
Oh, no.
All right. So for me, the earliest memory I have of my skin tone in particular was in relation to my mom's skin tone. My mom is a beautiful dark-skinned chocolate sister, real dark. And I remember when I was younger, you know, there were a number of like nicknames that she had around the family, around her friend group, because of her skin tone. I won't, you know, name any of them because we all can, you know, unfortunately, I mean, they were nicknames, but they were derogatory terms that, like, you know, we wouldn't say today. But I remember hearing a lot of conversation in the family around my mom's skin tone. And my mom is the darkest one out of her siblings. Darker than my grandmother as well. She got a different daddy, but, you know, we gonna mind our business. Anyway, and then also something that comes to mind is, you know, conversations about, like, you know, you can't stay outside too long because you're gonna get darker, right? And so, like, that would be a constant refrain that I would hear growing up, just to make sure that, like, I kept a presentable, if you will. That's in quotation marks for the people, you know, out there sabotaging us. A presentable kind of look about myself. And then I think, you know, that we can get into later issues with, like, you know, perceived issues as it relates to skin tone and stuff in high school. But those are, like, my earliest memories about all things, like, skin tone specific. What about you, Jared?
So you asked about the first time I was aware of my skin tone and the first time that I was made to feel a way about it. And those are two different, distinctly different experiences that I've had. Somehow I am lighter than both my mom and my dad. And so as a kid, there was always this, like, running joke about me being adopted that I kind of started to believe and thought, like, okay, no, but seriously. So what, am I adopted? And, like, now I don't have that. Like, I don't have that anymore. I'm very clearly both of my parents' kid, but, like, biologically speaking. And so that was kind of like my early, like, awareness of my skin tone. But then, as an adult, when I moved to Atlanta to go to Clark Atlanta University, that was the first time that I started to note my skin tone as being, like, a thing outside of my family. And, like, I would often be referred to as both high yellow and a red bone, which that didn't make sense to me because one had not heard those terms before. But I also just kind of was like, I don't understand, like, all this feedback that I'm getting about my skin tone. And, like, it was about my skin tone and about my accent. And it was about, like, all kinds of different things that were being pointed out to me about who I was and how I presented. Even if we're talking about, like, accent, I remember my first day of orientation, and I've probably told this on the show, but, like, a classmate from...
It's okay. You repeat yourself often.
Now, see, if I were to repeat slapping you upside the head, then I would be wrong. See?
Ooh, the abuse.
But no, I told the story before, I'm pretty sure, of being asked, like, where I was from by a student that was from Memphis, Tennessee, and him telling me that I spoke like I was on the Weather Channel so he could tell I was from California. So I was like, huh? But, yeah, like, it was skin. It was my accent, the way that I did X, Y, and Z. And so, like, that was kind of the first time that I started to really, like, feel that there was something different from some students.
And I remember you saying that, like, the way you received that criticism, it felt negative to you. Like, being light-skinned felt negative.
I've experienced it in multiple ways, right? Because there were some folks who would, like, be attracted to me because I was light-skinned and would not have a problem saying that. And then there were other times where it would be negative.
We're going to get to that later.
I'm sure. Because I produced this episode with you. But because it would be like, oh, I love me a light-skinned this. And I was like, that's weird. And it kind of feels like the way that white people fetishize black folks, like, oh, I'm really into black guys. But then it would also be negative about, like, oh, your light-skinned feelings or your light-skinned this, that, or the other. It was jarring for me because it was something I had not really experienced before.
Interesting. And you grew up in the Bay Area, right?
Correct.
So I feel like, and Jared Lucas, feel free to jump in and shut us up at any point that you feel compelled to sprinkle some wisdom on top of this conversation. But the reason why I asked about the Bay Area, because as somebody who grew up in the South, while I feel like we use terms like red bone and high yellow, I feel like they have multiple uses. And by which I mean, they can be used in, like, a pejorative way, right? To say, ooh, that high yellow motherfucker, you know? But it also can be used in, like you were saying, on the latter half of what you were saying, to denote, like, attraction. Like, red bone is a thing that you hear in a lot of rap songs as a good thing, right? For the type of person that, you know, we all are supposed to be wanting to get into it, all of that type of stuff. And so I found that interesting, how it was used in negative ways for you. Jared Lucas, what you got to add about what we said?
I'm just listening. No, I have a few thoughts. Okay, so these thoughts are in direct response to some brilliant insights both of you are surfacing here. I think one is that when we're talking about race, and when I say when we are talking about someone's and individual's race, their experience of embodying a color that is or is not like other people's, it's an objectifying experience, right? And so whether it is intended or framed positively or negatively, the reality is when someone is the subject of that conversation and a part of them is being disembodied in this way, again, irrespective of how it's being framed, it's objectifying. And I think some people unfortunately lean into that as affirmation or validation, and some people feel hurt by it, right? Or feel harmed by it. So I think that's one thing to note, that when we're talking about race and colorism as a product of a racist ideology, there's no avoiding that dynamic of objectification. The other piece, and Jarrett, you brought this up, is that colorism in a lot of ways is code for a whole set of things that actually go beyond color. It's about phenotypic traits, so hair texture, features, yes, skin, right? But nose, lips, eyelids, hair texture, all that. And it's also about behavioral traits, right? You talked about people observing, making observations about your accent, the way you spoke, Jarrett, and saying, oh, you must be, but also associating that with what they perceived as your color, right, to them. And so I think that when we talk about color, the reality of conscious and implicit bias is that they don't just stop at color, right? Like they bleed into all of the ways that we are perceiving a person and making judgments about the data that we're taking in, often incorrectly.
Kind of as you start talking about all the different ways that these things break down, I remember specifically having an older Black woman professor like stop me in the hallway and ask me what I was mixed with. And I told her I wasn't mixed, like both of my parents are, you know, perceivably Black. And she was like arguing with me about it, like telling me like that I wasn't being honest about it. And I was like, no, I'm not. And she was like, I mean, you've got to be mixed with something. You're high yellow with all them freckles. And I was like, do you want to like fight? Like, what do you want to do here? Like, I don't know what to say to you. But like, it started coming up more and more when I was in Atlanta, which, I mean, obviously there are Southern elements of that with me growing up in California in the Bay Area. But like, it was jarring for me standing in the hallway, like, can I just get to class? Travel, I see your wheels turning here.
My wheels are turning. First of all, because you got me together, Jared Lucas, already when you talk about the ways in which these comments about people's looks or whatever is like would you say dismembering?
Objectifying.
Disembodied. That's what you said.
Disembodies a part of someone.
See,
yeah.
You're doing the work there, Jared. But I'm also thinking about the ways in which we three Black, queer, assigned male at birth folks, like how colorism shows up in specifically queer contexts. Mm-hmm. Because I've been thinking about all of these presuppositions that we have in this cis-het patriarchal world that like talk about desiring lighter skinned folks, that talk about what's the saying, tall, dark, and handsome, you know, that idea that we often hear. And I just wonder if in either of your experiences that like queer spaces, which are sometimes known to buck some of those conventions, are different, or if we, you know, carry out those same, you know, ideals, I guess, is the right word.
I would have to say that I don't think it's fair or simple enough to say that I experienced that in a particular way in queer spaces, because I think that a lot of the ways that humans in society, especially United States of American society, are taught to experience and relate to attraction and desire is connected to gender. And so people who mm-hmm. are assigned male at birth are socialized to objectify people in relation to everything, frankly, but especially desire, right? And I think to a lesser degree, women and people socialized to be girls or women are encouraged to think about personality traits, think about characteristics, someone's ability to provide, value a whole different set of things that people can embody. Whereas boys and men are encouraged, celebrated for essentially commodifying, breaking down people into their parts. And so I think that when you're talking about queer spaces that are dominated by men, I am often seeing and experiencing a heightened level of objectification, and that dynamic I call disembodying parts of ourselves or commodifying parts of ourselves and saying, this is really attractive, that's not really attractive. And, you know, we see it in our apps, right? Like our profiles are often lists of what we do and don't want. and I'm speaking as a person who's on the apps with men mostly. People are out here, you know, men specifically are out here saying, I want this and that. And it's rarely about the totality of another person.
Mm-hmm. They love a no fats, no femmes, no Asians, et cetera, et cetera.
All that stuff. All that stuff.
I guess part of this is interesting for me because I think, like, I feel like so often we talk about white supremacy and anti-blackness on this show. And colorism is really, really rooted in white supremacy, right? Mm-hmm. And the way that we feel about dark-skinned folks and the way that we address dark-skinned folks is really rooted a lot in white supremacy, but also in anti-blackness, yes. right? And so there's this conversation, even if we look at it from the queer lens, where like there's rampant anti-blackness and white supremacy within queer communities, right? And we talk about this all the time when we talk about the movements for LGBTQ causes, whether that be marriage or, you know, employment or adoption or, you know, the myriad other issues, that they always seem to be led by, you know, white queer people, right? The court case is reflective of a white queer family's experience or a white queer couple's experience or a white queer military person's experience or what have you. And then, you know, that white supremacy and anti-blackness, you know, is pervasive within the community. But also the ways that we see that show up are in the ways that white men commodify and sexualize black folks, right? Like I've had sex with a white man or even a black man who has approached me and talked to me after the fact or at some point mentioned my skin tone. And especially when I was in my early 20s, like I didn't know what to do with that. It was like very disorienting. Mm-hmm. And especially for black folks who've ever been told by a white person how much they're into black people, how off-putting that is, right? And like Jared and I have had this conversation plenty of times about like, you don't know how what you're doing is working in the ways that you don't want it to, right?
Right.
And so it's that kind of a thing. And then when we think about queer spaces and anti-blackness, there's so much conversation. I mean, we just had, LA Black Pride, right? The fact that we have to have Black Pride, which we'll get into it a little bit later in a different kind of way, right? But the fact that we have to have Black Pride events, right, shows the division between like black and brown folks when it comes to queerness and white folks and their pride celebrations and the ways that we don't have spaces. But then if we're talking about it from a colorism perspective, I don't know that it feels necessarily markedly different. Travelle, do you feel like you've experienced colorism in a unique and specific way within queer communities or trans communities?
I was thinking about that as y'all were talking. I think my experiences in specific Black trans spaces has been different than my experience in just broader queer spaces. And I feel like in trans spaces, even as, you know, people are attracted to whomever they're attracted to, and when you're building relationships with people, there often seems to be an awareness of things like colorism and how the privilege that comes on the other side of colorism manifests itself in community in terms of opportunities, in terms of attraction, in terms of relationship building, that doesn't seem as present when I think back to just like general queer spaces. That could be a cause of like just the further marginalization that requires trans people to be more aware of some of these things. But like, there definitely is a difference in LGBTQ spaces versus like specific trans spaces for me. And I don't know what that's about, but yeah, I do feel a difference.
I think, well, Jared, were you going to say something?
I mean, very broadly, generally speaking, I think that to be trans, and especially to be a trans person of color, is to be invited to higher consciousness that most people will never experience. And I put it that way because
Amen.
We can point to Caitlyn Jenner, right? And say, to be trans is not to automatically be more conscious. But I think to be trans and Black is an invitation to a higher consciousness. And so, you know, as you're talking, Travelle, I go, yes, I'm shaking my head emphatically because my experience, and this is why I wanted to break down this monolithic idea of, you know, this issue in queer spaces. My experience has been that when I'm with queer women of any race, I have a very different relationship to my body, my sense of wholeness, my sense of acceptance when I'm among queer women. When I'm among non-binary and trans folks, again, a very different experience, very positive experience in relation to myself.
Can you explain like the distinctions between the two though?
Those? Yeah, I think that where I'm talking about being in spaces with queer women, I'm talking about women who are both in terms of gender expression and sexuality queer, but also in their political identity queer. And part of that experience is rejecting the way that women are socialized. Part of that is rejecting all of the stresses and expectations that are put on women and their bodies to be desirable according to other people and most often men, right? And so there's this really explicit and celebrated resistance to shaping your body and trying to fit someone else's notion of what makes you desirable, right? And by osmosis, maybe, spiritual osmosis, I feel like when I'm with queer women, I feel that. I feel like I too can be free from the bullshit, right? From trying to impress and attract and act, right? And when I've shared space with trans and non-binary folks, I think it only amplifies those dynamics. We're talking about people who have really had to wrestle with and come to own their bodies for what they want their bodies to be and what they want their identities to be, right? There's something really powerful about the trans experience in relation to self-determination, in relation to bodily autonomy, and in relation to resisting societal pressures to conform. And I think all of that absolutely translates into the realm of desirability and desirability politics. And so I feel extra free when I'm around people who are themselves extra free.
That's good. We wanted to talk about colorism and the other places that it might show up, but I do see on Travelle's face that there's something still processing. Did you want to?
There, something's always processing over here, honey. I be thinking, okay? I be thinking and processing.
Honey, I know we know it takes a little bit longer sometimes. I wanted to talk about...
Okay, you'd have to do all that. You'd have to do that.
But, I mean, some of the other places that we wanted to talk about seeing this, I've always kind of had a note in my mind about when we see instances of police violence against Black folks, right? I feel like, and I don't have like scientific data to back this up, but if I were to pull the information anecdotally and look at like the names that we tend to see that become hashtags with police killings of unarmed Black folks, right? More often than not, those folks tend to be darker skinned, you know, medium brown and darker skinned. And those stories tend to be the ones that we hear about the most. Obviously, oftentimes with cishet men, but like the dark skin is something that we see a lot. And I would say that there's probably also a correlation with the ways that we see, you know, the overemphasizing of criminality within Black communities as well, right? And the ways that we will show the picture of a Black person, and oftentimes that person tends to be brown or darker skinned.
It also, just to add on to that, I'm reminded of this thread that Deshaun Harrison did maybe 2 years ago, not only recognizing the disproportionate rates of darker skinned folks who face police violence, but also how a lot of those darker skinned folks are also bigger bodied folks, are also, you know, fat people. Yep. And how anti-blackness, anti-fatness, all of that works at the same time and manifests itself in the form of police violence on certain types of bodies over others. And so I think, you know, whether we're talking about Eric Garner or Mike Brown, we've seen the ways in which not only their darker skin, but their bodies have been like criminalized in very disgusting ways. So I just wanted to add that. Shout out to Deshaun. We'll have them on the podcast at some point down the line when their book comes out.
Okay,
go.
The other part of this that I think is interesting is when we first had this conversation about colorism on this show, and like I think the conversation that kind of sparked us doing an episode on this, it was about me talking about how light-skinned folks catch it from darker-skinned Black folks as if our Blackness is not valid or is not as valid in culture, right? And we had a conversation there about whether or not we like touched on a conversation about whether or not that is colorism. And I've been debating for myself whether or not that is colorism, because I recognize that isms don't always work in both directions, kind of like the way that we look at racism and like, you know, black people can't be racist because of like the way that the power structure works. And I don't know that I believe that my experience of, you know, color-based discrimination from darker-skinned Black people is the same thing as colorism. I don't think those are necessarily the same. It is a thing, but I don't know that it is necessarily colorism. And so I wanted to point that out, because that's really where we started this conversation. Jared, I see you nodding and long blanking me. Go ahead.
No, you're doing the work. We call this growth. No, I'm really appreciating
these. I hate you. You get that, right? Jesus Christ, you invite a bitch on the show.
I can't bear witness to...
No, go ahead.
I think you're naming a really important point that applies whenever we're talking about any kind of oppression that blends prejudice and power, right? Like, we can't call shit the same thing because it muddies responsibility, it muddies... who is actually experiencing the greatest harm in these systems and who's implicated as the oppressor, or what forces are implicated as oppressive forces. And so let's call it prejudice on the basis of your lightness. Like, let's call it something very precisely, because to say that colorism can move in any old direction actually misconstrues not only what colorism is, but also the roots of colorism. You said earlier, and I'm paraphrasing here, that, you know, white supremacy is basically colorism's grandpappy, right? And if we're not recognizing that colorism has poles, right? There's a north and a south, like, and it doesn't just flow any which direction. There's a hierarchy to it. There is whiteness at the top and Blackness at the bottom, and a whole lot of degrees of gray going down. And naming that is so, so important. So I actually just really appreciate your saying what your experience has been, but also being precise in separating that from what colorism is and how it shows up in communities as a system, as a ideology, as a culture, as opposed to interpersonal dynamics. That can still hurt.
Yeah, no, because I think that what's most important about what I was saying about that was that I recognize that I do have a level of privilege that comes along with my light skin, right? Yeah. And I mean, listen, after a year and a half, a year and some change of quarantine, it's lighter than it normally is. But I will say that it also is, but I also get from Black people who are not as light as I am, or that are darker, or however we appropriately word that, that sometimes it feels as if my Black experience is not a Black experience because I am not as dark as they are, or because I'm in my light skin feelings, and that's like dismissive of my experience. And so that is more so what I was talking about than I was trying to say, like, you know, colorism flows in both directions. We've already like kind of crossed time here at this point. But Travelle, you wanted to say something.
I do. We're gonna go more deeper into like colorism and how it shows up in media next week. But I did want to ask you, Jared, if you had just any like top of the line comments for people to think on about colorism in public, colorism in media, that you'd like to share as a little food for thought, a little amuse-bouche, if you will, for the conversation we plan to have next week.
Are you asking me to amuse people's bouches, or is this to Jared Hill?
Jared Lucas.
Okay.
I love amusing as a verb. I'm about to amuse your bouche.
Amusing your bouche. Okay. So I will say this, because when we're talking about media, something that always comes up with respect to race is representation and how powerful and important, mm-hmm. Et cetera, it is. So without detracting from that, I want to reference very quickly a study that was done at San Francisco State University with hundreds of students. This was several years ago, where professors ran an experiment where they showed some graphics that subliminally conveyed either the word ignorant or educated to a group of students. And then they showed them a picture, a photograph of a Black man. And then they took that image down and showed seven variations of that photo, one of which was the original, and three of which were lighter skinned versions of that person, and three were darker skinned, again, on a gradient. And they were asked to pick the original photo. And where the subliminal message of educated was conveyed, people always chose a lighter skinned version. And where the word ignorant was subliminally conveyed, people almost always chose the darker skinned or a darker skinned version of the photo. And I say that just because there's a really powerful connection between implicit bias and color. And it doesn't, like I said, stop at color. It becomes associations we have with intelligence, with safety, or conversely with the threat that we think somebody imposes on us. So, I think when we're talking about media, I would be really thoughtful about who we see representing Black people or various communities of color and how they might stack up against this conversation on colorism. Like, are we representing a real gradient of our community or not?
Jared, we told the lie that we were wrapping up here, but I do want to point out, like, I thought about you initially for this conversation because you and I were discussing In the Heights, and the conversation around colorism for In the Heights. You live
in the Heights.
You live in the Heights. There in New York City, right? What was your kind of perspective on the colorism conversation around In the Heights?
I mean, I went into the theater excited, and I left the theater excited. Great movie, and for most of the movie, I was looking for my neighbors. I was like, where are they? Yeah. I don't see the people who live in my building. I don't see the people who are running the car services and bodegas in my neighborhood, right? And sure, there were some people in the chorus, you know, doing pirouettes in the background who look like people that I see on a daily basis. And the main cast did not actually represent what I see in this neighborhood. And I think that that is the complaint that a lot of people very legitimately had, a criticism and observation to which Lin-Manuel Miranda responded, you know, we're hearing you and we fell short. And my thought was, did you fall short or did you land exactly where you aimed?
My God.
Well, all right.
My Lord.
All right. I want to thank Jared Lucas for being a part of this conversation. For those of you that remember, a few weeks ago, I mentioned that I was hosting Vision, and thanked the folks that donated that were listeners to Fanti. Jared, take one quick moment and tell people about the work that you do at Stonewall.
We are a foundation that is by and for LGBTQ people and our allies, asterisk on the word allies, and we really put at the center of our grant making and scholarship provision and micro granting racial justice and equity. And so if you care about LGBTQ issues and you want to see those addressed with racial consciousness and also with sensitivity towards the importance of trans experience, then we could be a home for you.
Yeah. Okay. So for more information on Stonewall Community Foundation, go to stonewallfoundation.org. Jarrett, thank you so much for being here. We're going to take a quick break. We want to know what you all think, though. You can tweet or post using the hashtag FantiFam. We'll be jumping in, responding to your posts on Twitter and Instagram from @FantiPodcast. Want to know what you all think. I'm sure you have something to say. Coming up next, why y'all hate us so much and listener feedback and our dishonorable mentions. Don't go anywhere. FantiFam's back in a moment.
Schmanners. Noun. Definition. Rules of etiquette designed not to judge others, but rather to guide ourselves through everyday social situations.
Hello, Internet. I'm your husband, host Travis McElroy.
And I'm your wife, host Teresa McElroy.
Every week on Schmanners, we take a look at a topic that has to do with society or manners. We talk about the history of it. We take a look at how it applies to everyday life. And we take some of your questions. And sometimes we do a biography about a really cool person that had an impact on how we view etiquette. So join us every Friday and listen to Schmanners on MaximumFun.org or wherever podcasts are found.
Manners, schmanners. Get it?
Hey, it's John Moe. And look, these are challenging times for our mental and emotional health. I get it. That's why I'm so excited for my new podcast, Depresh Mode. We're tackling depression, anxiety, trauma, stress, the kinds of things that are just super common but don't get talked about nearly enough. Conversations that are illuminating, honest, and sometimes pretty funny with folks like Patton Oswalt, Kelsey Darra, and Open Mike Eagle.
I have this public-facing self, and then I have my emotional self that tends to stay hidden. It was about finding a way to communicate to somebody that, like, there's terrible shit going on back here.
Plus psychiatrists, psychologists, and all kinds of folks. On Depresh Mode, we're working together, learning, helping each other out. We're a team. Join our team. Depresh Mode for maximum fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back, welcome back, welcome back.
Wow. Thank you for that, Mason Betha, John Travolta nod.
We're going to get into our listener feedback segment, your opportunity to send us your thoughts about all of the greatness that we do here. Or you might have a misplaced negative feedback, like our reader today, our writer today, Eric. So Eric says, hi, Travel and Jared. This is my first time writing in, and I'm sorry it's with negative feedback. I do have so much positive feedback for the show, too, but this moment from the latest episode hit me wrong, and I wanted to share why. FYI, this is in response to, I believe this was on our boycotting episode. Eric is responding to a listener letter that I believe we received talking about the girls. And quote, so Eric says,
the girls,
quote, the girls. Yes. End quote. So Eric says all these great stuff about us and liking how we engage with our, you know, listeners and the feedback, says thank you to Laura and Jordan for all the work you do. Okay. In the boycotts and cancel culture episode, it didn't feel good to hear your response to Bernie's letter about quote unquote girls as a gender neutral term. I hear and agree with Jared's points about queer men reclaiming girls to push back against the ways that feminizing language is weaponized against them, as well as it being a response to quote-unquote guys being ubiquitously treated as neutral in mainstream slash straight culture. I don't use guys myself because I know that it hurts trans femme people in my life. If you'd listen and respect when a trans feminine person says that using guys hurts her, can you see why a trans masculine person might feel that using girls hurts him too? I'm a trans masculine person attracted to masculine people, and it can be really hard to follow and embody my sexuality, especially in interaction with cis queer men, and still hold my gender. For most of my life, I quote unquote was a quote unquote girl who was having sex with quote unquote boys. Being referred to as a girl or girls in queer spaces, regardless of the intent of the person doing it, can bring up feelings of dysphoria, erasure, and exclusion. It touches old hurt, and it can shut me down. It also touches ways that feminizing language is specifically weaponized against trans masculine people to erase our identities. It's just a different experience from what I heard you two describing. I have my stuff to work out, and I can take care of myself around all of those feelings. Maybe my quote-unquote liberation does look like being one of the girls eventually. In the meantime, I think trans mass folks should get space to have complicated feelings about girls as a gender-neutral term. We should be able to say that it doesn't feel good, and that should be heard. With love, Eric. So first off, Eric, thanks for writing in. Second off, Eric, I think that this is yet another instance of, with all due respect, people hearing what they want to hear in our conversations and not hearing what we said. We did not say that the reader of that previous letter just had to deal with being called girl. That's not what we said. What we said is that for us and how we use it in gender neutral ways. But just to me, describing the ways that we use a term is not automatically like directing it at an individual. And I feel like I specifically was clear to not dismiss that reader's issues with the word girls, but also to assert how I use girls. And I just feel like that got lost. And this letter from Eric felt like we were being like taken to task for dismissing someone's thoughts. And that's not how I recall that conversation.
I was kind of sitting back in the cut as I was thinking about how to respond to this, because I do think we have a lot of instances where people hear something different than what we said. But I also think about the ways that we discuss intention versus impact. And so I'm thinking about that as well. And I'm not sure how that applies in this situation. Also, I just want to acknowledge that I love that y'all are arguing with other listeners in the inbox. They're like inbox battles going on.
We should say, right, Eric isn't the only one who also expressed, you know, not this specifically. We haven't gotten any other emails that express this specifically, but we have gotten a lot of feedback about whether or not from people across the gender spectrum and presentation spectrum about whether girls can be gender neutral.
Yeah.
But keep going. I'm sorry.
No, I'm going to need to sit with this one because I think there's a piece of the intent versus impact conversation and like how it lands for certain people versus other people. I think that's an interesting dynamic of a conversation. So I get that.
Let me be clear, just in case I wasn't before. And by before, I mean 5 minutes ago. The impact of an individual who hears girls, all of that is super valid. I'm just saying that's not what we said. That's all I'm saying.
I don't know why, but as you said, I just want to be clear. I thought that was going to end with, I don't care what you think. And I don't know why.
No.
That's where I definitely thought that
I was do going. Care. And
no,
I
know.
And I do want to reassert that what Eric is saying about how the girls can be interpreted by trans masculine or masculine people more broadly is super valid.
Sure.
That just ain't what I said.
Okay. It's time for us to get into our dishonorable mentions. These are the stories of people that caught our attention this week that deserve a call out either for their good or for their stupid. We both wanted to shout out this person. It is Tuesday as we record this. This morning, it was announced that Nicole Hannah-Jones, after finally being given tenure at UNC Chapel Hill, has announced that
I will not be teaching on the faculty of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And instead, I'm going to be the inaugural night chair in race and journalism at Howard University.
If you're not familiar with the story, short version is Nicole Hannah-Jones got a new position at UNC Chapel Hill that always comes along with tenure. However, they decided she would not be getting it.
There was a great deal of political interference by conservatives who don't like the work that I've done, particularly the 1619 project, and also by the powerful donor who gave the largest donation in the 70-year history of the journalism school. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty clear that my tenure was not taken up because of political opposition, because of discriminatory views against my viewpoint, and I believe my race and my gender.
Shout out to Nicole Hannah-Jones and Ta-Nehisi Coates, both who are going to be teaching over at Howard. And, Howard has like a very strong talent acquisition moment happening right now. And I just, shout out to them.
I mean, shout out to the Grants. They will join the one and only
Felicia Rashad. and I think there was a $15 million endowment that came that is a part of that new situation that's coming with Nicole Hannah-Jones and more money to come, according to them. So shout out to Nicole Hannah-Jones, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Howard, And a dishonorable mention to the girls over at UNC Chapel Hill. And I did say the girls, sorry, if there's anyone that's offended by that.
My honorable / dishonorable mention, my dishonorable mention is going to go to Brandon Anthony and the folks over at LA Black Pride. If you have not been paying attention or have not seen, long story short, the raptress, if you will, Chica, was hired to host an event. She hosted that event, had a very horrible, negative time, and verbalized that on social media, and then was responded to by Brandon Anthony, who is a party promoter here in the LA area, does a lot of the Black LGBTQ events here. And Brandon showed his ass and was super fatphobic and misogynistic, and there was a little bit of transphobia in there too, and Chica's not even trans, and so just a lot of things. And then there was another issue apparently that involved an assault, according to Amaya Scott, who also was supposed to do something for LA Black Pride this past weekend. And so there's a lot of just drama around this whole situation. And so if you haven't seen or paid attention, you can go over to Chica's Instagram and Twitter, as well as Amaya Scott's Instagram and Twitter. They've shared everything, and somebody needs to put Brandon Anthony on some ice, which means he needs to sit down and mind his business and cool off.
To be clear, not a death threat coming from Travell Rajon Anderson.
I did. That's yes. Because y'all not about to get me hoodie.
Oh, it is time now for
Black History is happening every day.
Every now and then a moment comes along that truly speaks to the truth of the title of this segment, that Black history isn't only in the past, but it is happening every day. TikTok user, I believe this is Who She Naja, grabbed her camera and changed me at my core with a hymn that has been in my weary spirit for probably weeks now. Take a listen.
I'm about to go lay down. Yay, yay.
Oh, glory.
Go. Lay down. I'm about to go lay down.
Yes, Father God.
Yes, God.
Lay it down. Say, go lay down.
Go on and lay down.
Go lay down. Yeah.
Sing.
Go lay down. Hey, go lay down. Go lay down.
Baby, amen. When I tell you this, literally every night when I go to lay down, I hear, go lay down.
Go lay down.
There are so many remixes to Go Lay Down. The most recent one is from Pastor Greenleaf.
Yes.
Over on Owens Greenleaf. I can't think of his name now, and he's like a legend.
Me either.
Oh, wow. We're both anti-Black.
He's okay. Like an older version of Lamon Rucker.
Okay, no.
Which is not helpful, but...
Not at all, but it is... His name is like Keith... But I'm looking it up right now. Don't do this to me, okay?
Me too. Don't do this to me.
His name...
Keith David.
Keith David, as I say it. Amen.
He look like an older Lamon Rucker.
All right. Hate you. But yes, there are so many remixes of it. And shout out to, I believe her name is Naja, for giving us a hymn that will stick with me for the ages. Before we get out of here, we want to let you know if this conversation piqued your interest and you want more of this.
Good.
Check out other episodes that related to this conversation. Jarrett Lucas, who's on this episode, is also on episode 26. Actually, one of our more pivotal episodes called Okay Allies. Now let's get in formation. You'll understand why we are...
And I slay.
You'll understand why we are wary with the language of allies It's a really, really important episode. So go ahead and check that out. It's episode 26. We thank you so much for listening. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, we ask that you give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. Let us know about why you love the show so much or why you hate Travelle, either one. If you have a comment, suggestion, or something else about this week's show, you can tweet or Instagram at us using our handle at Fanti Podcast and using the hashtag FantiFam. Or you can shoot us an email. Our email address is fanti@maximumfun.org.
And if you want to become a financially contributing member of the Fanti fam, you can go over to MaximumFun.org/join and give us a little coins. Our music is brought to you by the one and only Corece. That's Core.ece, wherever you get Slayworthy audio. And our graphics are done by Ashley Wen and the folks over at Moonhouse Creative.
Our producer is Laura Swisher. This is our first time in a long time only just saying one name. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
Travelle.
Okay, what am I doing?